All right, good evening to everyone. This is not working. That's where there are two. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 23. Sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we're discussing the Camp David Accords and the peace treaty with Egypt. The night of May 17th, 1977 was forever memorialized in the history of the State of Israel as the night of the Mahapach, the upheaval, the revolution. For the first time in its history, after 29 years of losing elections, Menachem Begin's party won more seats than any other party, and so was positioned to become the government of Israel. We are by now accustomed to it because Likud has won most of the elections since, but it was a revolution. The man who was anathematized by Ben-Gurion as a fascist and a demagogue, the man with whom Ben-Gurion would never shake hands, not even mention his name in public, the man who was stigmatized as a warmonger, and for some worse, he also believed in the free market, that man, Begin, would now sit in Ben-Gurion's seat atop the government of Israel. So it was a new experience. He was born in 1913 in Brisk. Ariel Sharon's grandmother was his midwife, his mother's midwife. Follower of Jabotinsky, Rosh Beitar in Poland before the war. Family was destroyed in the Holocaust. He was an officer in the in Anders Free Polish Army, imprisoned by the Soviets in Siberia, and then freed when the Nazis declared war, invaded the USSR, June 22nd, 1941. And he was also a proud Jew, which was a novelty for Israel's leaders. So he was not fully observant, but he was never Michal Shabbos in public, wore tefillin every day, and he really was at home in the world of Torah because of his origins. And Begin lived a very simple life, a throwback almost. Him and Shamir really never made any money from public service. He owned only one suit, until he became the prime minister. For decades, he hosted a weekly shal shudis in a two-room apartment, a modest apartment in Tel Aviv, where he lived from right of the time the statehood was declared, raised three children in a two-bedroom apartment. A shal shudis, anyone could walk in and say hello and ask questions and talk to him, and he continued that as prime minister in the official residence until the security services made him stop. And even then, he continued with a Motzoi Shabbos shir in the Prime Minister's residence in Tanakh, which he'd invite leading Talmidei Chachamim and thinkers to discuss and analyze different events and stories in Tanakh and their ramifications for policy and for current events. Twice a year, my father used to hear this regularly, he would recite the Haftorah in the Great Synagogue, once on Shabbos Nachmu, which was his bar mitzvah, Menachem Nachmu, when he was born. And on second day Rosh Hashanah also. And he read it like a Jew would read a Haftorah. And I grew up in Beis Torah, remember this vividly, there was a certain Kohen, got an Aliyah maybe once or twice a month, in his Mishaberach, he would always mention, after the family, Ves Menachem ben Zevdov. And I asked him who it was once, and he said, it's Menachem Begin. Because he himself had been on the Alta Lena, and he was, Begin inspired such a loyalty in his followers. He was a person of strong beliefs and values, and the question is, did he reflect or betray those values by signing the Camp David Accords, or both, or was it something else? How did he decide to launch Israel into this great unknown, and how has it worked out? Looking at the election, in retrospect, it should have been obvious, like many things are obvious in retrospect. The Rabin government of the 70s was always unstable. We discussed last time it was riven by the personal dispute between Rabin and his defense minister, Peres. Indeed, Peres ran against Rabin in 1977 for the leadership of the Labor Party and its allies, then known as the Ma'arach, the alignment. And Peres lost by about 40 votes or so out of almost 3,000 cast. So it was a defeat for the hapless Peres, who would never be elected prime minister outright, but it's not exactly a resounding victory for a sitting prime minister. Soon, though, Rabin had to resign as prime minister. In any event, he remained as the caretaker because he and his wife had continued to maintain a small bank account, less than $10,000, in the United States from when Robin had served as the ambassador, but which was a violation of the draconian socialist currency laws then in force in Israel. So Peres became the party leader. In fact, he remained the party leader until 1992, when Rabin returned to defeat him. In the election, 1977, Likud won 43 seats, up from 39, capitalizing on the fatigue with labor even after the legacy of the Yom Kippur War, corruption scandals involving not only Leah Rabin, but also the housing minister Avram Ofer, who had committed suicide rather than face charges. Labor won 32 seats, down from 51. It's a decline of almost 40%. Most of the labor defectors voted for a new party, Hatnua LeDemokratit Shinui, or Dash, also known as the Democratic Movement for Change, which was the Yesh Atid of its time, headed by Yigael Yadin. They won 15 seats, promising change. Politicians are always promising change, and the gullible masses are always buying it. So that party, Dash, would splinter within 2 years, with one component, Shinui, remaining well into the 1990s as a fringe left party, and then being resurrected again in 2003 before dying again. But it's the first tile, Tnua, well, that was adopted by Tzipi Livni in the last election. Begin, this had never happened before, the morning after the election, went to the Kotel, said Tehillim. Later that week, he went to Elon Moreh in the Shomron, and there he promised to build many more Elon Morehs as people carried him on their shoulders, sang Begin Melch Yisrael. And he immediately began using the biblical names for the heartland of Israel, Judea, Samaria, over and over again. After all, what is the West Bank? It means a territory defined by a river and by the Arabs on the East Bank. Well, we're on the West Bank of the Hudson. We're just as much the West Bank. So that would end, and in Israel, in his formal statements, the government would stop using him until the left came back into power. But to the absolute horror of the left, Begin first formed a coalition with the Mafdal, the religious party, National Religious Party, with 12 seats, with Agudat Yisrael for the very first time in government, 4 seats, and 2 from Ariel Sharon's Shlom Tzion party that ran on a platform of Jordan as Palestine. If you do the math, that gave Begin exactly 61 seats in the Knesset, a bare majority. Months later, it would allow Begin to bring in Dash on his terms, but then he added a 62nd seat in the Knesset, scandalizing Labor by appointing Moshe Dayan as the foreign minister. Now, Labor was portraying Begin, as they always did, as a warmonger and a caretaker prime minister on whom the people would soon turn once they found out who he really was. And they resented Dayan for giving Begin legitimacy, which is one reason Begin did it, and another reason why Dayan did it. He himself was looking for rehabilitation after the Yom Kippur War fiasco. And Begin was looking for international street credibility, but this also engendered what has too often happened on Israel's right, a lack of confidence in their policies, as if they're too embarrassed to govern on the policies that got them elected. So it's as if Begin was looking to change the reputation that he had, but it was that reputation that got him elected and endeared him to the people. So the move really bewildered his supporters, many of whom had their eyes on that prize, foreign ministry, but they said little, because Begin was the solitary leader of Herut, and of course, a legend. Well, he was new to the office, but he conducted himself with the dignity and the self-assurance that could be expected from someone who had devoted his life to pursuit of certain principles, namely, the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and the protection of Jewish life. So this was an historic vindication of his life, and Begin could be expected, above all, to protect the lives of Jews and the integrity of the land of Israel. Nothing was dear to him. Those two desires, noble for sure, would run into a brick wall, unsympathetic to Jews, although to what extent only became clear long after he left the presidency, a brick wall in the form of the unctuous Jimmy Carter. Now, Carter was elected in 1976, and he really was the first unexpected president of modern times. That is to say, a year before the election, you would not have imagined that such a person could be elected the president. We're living through a similar thing now, by the way. But Carter was able to defeat a gaggle of opponents in the Democratic primaries by presenting himself as an alternative to Washington. Novelty happens every election. An honest person, I'll never lie to you, which is a contrast to Watergate, and even to President Ford, who was an accidental president, who succeeded Nixon when Nixon resigned the office. And then Ford antagonized people, meaning the media, when he pardoned Nixon a month later. That led to talk of a deal, never proven. And in retrospect, most people today think that Ford was wise in doing what he did, enabling the country to move on. But he did alienate the media, who portrayed him as a clumsy dunce, and that harmed his chances in the election. So Carter ran as an outsider against Washington, ran for honest government. The problem was he was a complete unknown. He was a one-term governor of a southern state. But like Obama in 2008, it turned out to be a perfect storm. Because he was a southern governor, he cut into Nixon's strategy. He had a nice smile, very toothy smile, and he tapped into a nation that had tired of Washington scandals, and he eked out a victory. It was a squeaker. In fact, Ford was surging in the polls when Election Day came, and he just lost. Now, Ford had delegated much of his foreign policy to Kissinger, his Secretary of State, and Henry Kissinger threatened Israel into accepting a series of disengagements, meaning withdrawals from in Sinai and the Golan Heights, even announcing a reassessment of U.S.-Israel relations in 1975 when Israel had not yet surrendered. The revisionism about the treachery of Henry Kissinger, now that he's past 90, is in full swing, trying to salvage his reputation for Jewish history. But Rabin did eventually agree after wresting what he considered to be a major concession from the Egyptians. The Egyptians in the Sinai II agreement entered into a non-belligerence clause, committing themselves not to use force against Israel. I mean, it sounds strange. What right do they have to use force that they agree not to use force? But that, in fact, was the first step to a treaty. When Carter took office, his messianism was such that he decided, much like Kerry today, to solve the Middle East problems once and for all, and he saw the problem primarily as a lack of flexibility on Israel's part. It's interesting, there was no present crisis in the Middle East that compelled him to get involved in Israel and its neighbors' conflict, but he did, and it was just because it was him. He saw this as a mission. Soon after taking office in February 1977, Carter met with Rabin at the White House just a month later. That was the meeting where the following happened, became a very famous story. Carter liked to take foreign dignitaries in order to soften them up to the White House residence to look at his daughter Amy while she was sleeping. So it's developed some sort of personal connection. Everyone say something cute when they saw her asleep. Carter said to Rabin, let's go look in on Amy. And the dour Rabin said, I'm not interested. And that ended that. How deflating for a father. Carter said of Rabin, he writes in his memoirs, that talking to him is like talking to a dead fish. And he was further angered when he asked Rabin if they'd met in the office for a few hours about their various positions. And then at night after dinner, Carter asked Rabin, so tell me now, what's your real fallback position? And Rabin said, I have only one set of positions. Privately, Carter told Rabin that Israel would have to agree to return to the 1967 borders with minor rectifications, a phrase that's now in vogue again today. But from Carter's perspective, there was a major concession made by Rabin, who said that for real peace, Israel would, he said, make territorial compromises in all sectors. Now, this would later be invoked against Begin, but was in fact a personal and a verbal commitment, not a governmental commitment, but nonetheless became a typical pattern that we're living through also today. Whenever Israel makes or even suggests a concession or commitment of any kind, even if the concession or commitment is contingent on something similar from the other side, even if there's no reciprocity, Israel's concession or commitment is filed away and becomes the starting point for the next round of negotiations. Begin would object to this process, as has Netanyahu a little less successfully in the last year and a half. Now, Dayan added some limiting details to Rabin's offer. Dayan said Israel would not withdraw from Sharm el-Sheikh in order that they should control their own access to the Red Sea. Two wars had already been fought because aggressive Egyptians had blockaded Israeli shipping. But Rabin told Carter that Israel could be there without formal sovereignty. They'll just have a presence there with Egyptian permission. And he said Israel would not come down from the Golan, and that Israel could accept a Palestinian-Jordanian state, meaning a state under Jordanian auspices, but not a third state. And he also said Israel would not withdraw to the 1967 borders. Carter disagreed, was not happy. And for the first time, a week or two after the meeting, it was March 8th, 1977, Carter announced in a speech that he considers the settlements illegal and that Israel would have to withdraw from Yesha with minor border rectifications. You see, it's astonishing, even the language never changes. It's just that the world, different people from the same countries, waits for Israel to break down and acquiesce. And it was a week later that Israelis were horrified. Carter, for the first time, spoke of the need for a Palestinian homeland, shocking not only Israel, but even his own State Department. One official called the statement dumb, utterly stupid, because Carter gave away essentially an American gift to the Arabs while getting nothing in return. It was a shift in America's position, and something that Rabin right away knew would harm him in the upcoming election. Carter moved full speed ahead anyway, and the shift existed and was perceived by Israelis, and that was part of the reason why they wanted a stronger minister to oppose Carter. Well, what were Carter's motives? So his animus towards Israel was not yet known, but again, looking back, many feel that he was a different type of Democrat because he was an outsider to Washington, had no Washington roots, no Washington base of support, had no personal ties to Jews at all. Jews did not factor in his life in any significant degree. So he wasn't the typical Democrat that, for example, AIPAC had befriended. He had never served with any Jews, not the Jews in Congress that others had. He wasn't at all close to the Jewish establishment, not that that establishment was that dynamic or courageous to begin with. But Carter never had to worry about the Jewish vote. It was not a factor at all in his campaign for governor. And running for president, he was benefited that Jews had soured on Ford, for sure, but Jews are reflexive Democrats, voted for him anyway, because that is what they did. In 1976, Jews voted for Carter 71% to 27% for Ford. And even when Jews perceived him as hostile, 1980, he still won a plurality of the Jewish vote over Reagan, 45 to 39%, which in any event was the lowest percentage any Democrat ever got of the Jewish vote since 1920 and thenceforth. Asa Weitzman, nonetheless, true to form, even in the 1980 campaign, said he was a great friend of Israel, and that was that. But Carter was also a Bible-believing Southern Baptist, but the Bible he believed in was never especially friendly to Jews, nor to the idea of Jewish nationalism. But it did... excuse me. Thank you. It did give him a very passionate commitment to human rights. And Carter, therefore, began his support for underdogs across the world, even if the top dog was pro-American. So that would result in the overthrow of a number of pro-American dictators across the globe, like the Shah, like Marcos, Somoza, etc., and their replacement with even more brutal, but now anti-American dictators. And of course, his support for the underdog led him to become an advocate for the so-called Palestinians. Now, something else occurred that profoundly changed the dynamic in the Middle East. Carter moved to look away from Nixon's detente policy and embraced the Soviets as partners in world governance. He really believed on some level he could move them away from communism and repression towards a more open, free, and prosperous society. He really believed that. As he was shocked when they invaded Afghanistan in 1979. Part of that was bringing the Soviets into Middle East peacemaking in a way that Kissinger, ever playing his power politics game, had successfully thwarted. So after Begin won in May of 1977, the U.S. was shocked. Carter was not happy. Within 1 month after taking office, Begin made his first visit to the United States, and he was vilified in many quarters. Most infamously, remember, Time magazine wrote about him, Begin rhymes with Fagin, vilified as a terrorist, a warmonger, and especially something that the American Jewish establishment had not yet encountered in Israeli politics, the proud Jew. He came first to New York, July 1977, a visitor of Soloveitchik in Washington Heights, whom he had known from Brisk. Then he went to Lubavitcher Rebbe at 770. You can hear his remarks on YouTube. It's very interesting. Begin was asked as he left. The Rebbe gave him good guidance and a blessing, etc. And he said, what do you anticipate from these fateful meetings ahead in Washington? So Begin said, I do not call them fateful meetings because the people of Israel, the Jewish people, are an eternal people. And their lot and future are not dependent on a political meeting with the leader of the free world. On his next visit, by the way, covers all the bases, went to visit Moshe Feinstein, the Lower East Side. Here, it was July 77 with the Rav. He suggested, with the Rav's approval, they should change the date of Yom HaShoah to Tisha B'Av, as that was the day on which Jews commemorate all tragedies. The Rav agreed, but nothing ever came of that plan. It's a good one nonetheless, but the Israelis did not want it at all for a variety of reasons. Begin then went to Washington. The immediate issue on the agenda was Carter's desire to convene an international conference in Geneva, with all the parties to the conflict in attendance, the whole Arab world, under the sponsorship of the U.S. and the USSR. Now, Israelis had always been wary of international conferences for obvious reasons. The one in Geneva after the Yom Kippur War had not gone particularly well. We're an Am Levavad Yishkon, we're a nation that dwells alone. So however you look at it, if you have an international conference, the countries assembled would almost necessarily vote the way they want. Be 25-1, maybe with one abstention. So why go when you know the outcome would be so deleterious? Begin came to the White House with the media trumpeting the tensions to come, predicting a breakdown in relations, acrimony. Before they met formally, there was a dinner at the White House. It was the first kosher dinner ever hosted in the White House. They sat down to eat. Begin put on a yarmulke, made a motzi. We take all this for granted. Some reporters and the Jews present were aghast. And then he spoke and he said, I quote, I'm not ashamed to say that I do believe with all my heart in divine providence. Were it not for divine providence, where would we be today or tonight? We were sentenced to death, all of us. And the life of every one of us is a present. We could have been there in the trains and in the camps. As the wife of my friend and secretary pointed to some of the audience, young lady was, having spent 3 years in Auschwitz, having looked every day upon that smoke coming from the chimneys and knowing what happened. And there was a pattern in Begin's life because he was a survivor, because his parents were killed, his brother was killed. Begin always referenced the Holocaust, and it was a dominant force in his worldview. And of course, he was very intelligent and very clever. In the first meeting with Carter, Begin brought with him Shmuel Katz, old-time Irgunist. They'd been in the underground, South Africa, correct. That's where he's from. old-time Irgunist, author of the definitive biography of Jabotinsky, The Lone Wolf. Kat started to speak at length, and to Carter's horror, about Jewish rights to the entire land of Israel, about how halting settlement building, even temporarily, would, I quote, prejudge the outcome of negotiations. And both Shmuel Katz and Begin referred to the captured territories as Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Again, horrors. Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was the National Security Advisor, they could scarcely contain their dismay. When Begin spoke, he spoke maybe 35, 40 minutes about Israel, about the Jewish people's rights, the land of Israel, and then he continued, took from his pocket a piece of paper that said that there are 11 towns in America named Hebron, and 6 named Bethlehem, and 5 named Shiloh. One of them happened to be near Plains, Georgia. He said, no, you would not be able to say to any Jew in America, you can't live in one of those towns. So by what morality could a Jewish government ban Jews from living in the originals? And he would not be a party to such discrimination. A fretful Carter noted that he saw no moderation in what was being said. And a collision was likely at some point in the future, but not yet. The truth is both parties wanted this initial meeting to work. Carter to limit domestic criticism, that he was unfriendly to Israel. And Begin to offset attacks on him as a right-wing warmonger, which is a staple of Israel's then exclusively leftist media. Begin emerged to say that the only confrontation they had was with the heat. If you think back, unfortunately, I remember it vividly, it was July 1977, temperatures in New York and Washington exceeded 100 degrees for days on end. Begin, in fact, had come the week after the blackout in New York City that had caused all the mass looting. It had just happened. I found myself stuck on the subway a few times that week. It's like 120 degrees. To Begin, a withdrawal from Yesha was an affront to Jewish history. He told Carter an Arab state was a mortal danger to Israel, and he refused to accept any guarantees. Channeling Levi Eshkol, he said, there is no guarantee that can guarantee a guarantee. And then he concluded with this long peroration. He began to talk about the Holocaust, about how his parents had been murdered, how he would never again entrust the security of Jewish children to foreigners. And his eyes welled with tears, and Carter was speechless. He could make no progress, but in fact he wasn't at all moved by it. Now there were two big concessions that he made. The reason why the public spin put on the meeting was so positive. Begin said he could agree to substantial withdrawals from Sinai in exchange for a true peace, although not at all in Yesha. And he said he was not averse to Israel attending a Geneva conference. From Israel's perspective, the meetings went well. Begin had asserted himself. That Sunday, he went on the American news shows, Face the Nation, Meet the Press, and he first explained to the audience the significance of that day. It was Tisha B'Av that day, and he said why the Jewish people would never compromise in Yerushalayim, and he spoke about the Churban. In August, Begin offered autonomy with the possibility of citizenship to what he called the Arab inhabitants of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. But when new settlements were approved by the cabinet that month, it was August 77, Beit El, Tekoa, Carter denounced them again as illegal, obstacles to peace, first time that mantra was used. Actually, they're obstacles to war, but nonetheless, Begin felt he'd been crystal clear. Jews had the right to settle anywhere in the land of Israel, period. But Carter felt he'd been betrayed, and not for the first time. On August 22nd, Dayan met King Hussein in London, in secret, of course, and Hussein said that he would not negotiate on behalf of the Palestinians, nor would he agree to have any responsibility for them. And obviously, in 1974 in Rabat, the PLO had been designated by the Arabs as the only spokesman, so Jordan backed off, and Dayan realized there'd be no progress at all with Jordan. Now, interestingly, at the White House, Begin also hinted, without going into details, that he might be meeting Sadat soon. He didn't say that Dayan had already been negotiating with Egypt first through the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu, and then later in August, Dayan flew to Morocco, also in secret, to meet with a Moroccan intermediary, and then with King Hassan of Morocco himself. How does a man with an eye patch conceal his identity? Took off the patch and wore sunglasses. It wouldn't be recognized. And in Morocco, Dayan began a series of meetings with the Egyptian deputy prime minister. All of this in order to bypass Carter. In this, ironically, Begin and his Egyptian interlocutor, Anwar Sadat, found common cause. Now, Sadat was a fascinating character. He was born in 1918 during World War II. He was in the Egyptian army. He was jailed by the British for pro-Nazi sympathies, became an anti-monarchist revolutionary together with Nasser until finally becoming Nasser's vice president, who succeeded him when Nasser died. But Sadat was always perceived as a bit lackluster. I was frustrated by Nasser, of course. Colorless, lacking ambition, lacking courage. His visit to Israel changed the dynamic of the conflict overnight. Now, note again, it was in the works for months. The only surprise was that he actually did it. And it did take courage. Why did he do it? So he didn't become a lover of Israel overnight. There were three primary factors, all compelling. First, from his perspective, Egypt had regained its honor by the early successes in the Yom Kippur War, which Egypt considered a victory, regardless of how it ended. Egypt had recaptured the Suez Canal. They've been able to bleed Israel and even parade Israeli POWs in Cairo. That being said, he knew the military option was no longer viable. Israel would never again be surprised, and Israel possessed the nuclear option also. By 1975, the Arab oil weapon had also fizzled, so Sadat realized if Egypt was to regain the Sinai, it would have to be done through negotiations. Second, on October 1st, Carter began pushing strongly for a Geneva conference in December, as he and the Soviets announced their framework for the negotiations. But you'll recall that Sadat had expelled the Soviet advisors in 1972, and even though they were to assist Egypt during the Yom Kippur War, Sadat had made a strategic decision to turn away from the Soviets and move into the Western orbit. The last thing he wanted was to bring Brezhnev into the negotiations as his patron. And in that, Carter and company completely miscalculated, and in fact were nonplussed when Sadat's visit took place, and were not supportive of it at first. In fact, the official statement was, this can only help convene the Geneva conference. But they didn't realize or want to accept that Begin and Sadat were going in a different direction. In any event, the Syrians announced they would not attend Geneva. Sadat did not want to be hamstrung by the Syrians. And the Israelis were also irritated by the Geneva terms in which Carter was insisting on some form of PLO participation. To Begin, and this never changed, Arafat was Hitler and the PLO were Nazis, as he called them, beasts walking on two legs. And third, and related to this, Sadat had decided for two reasons to reorient Egypt as an American ally and not as a Soviet ally, both to drive a wedge between Israel and its patron, the U.S., and that worked. Think about it. Every arms deal with Israel since then has included, of necessity, something for Egypt. And because Sadat was desperate for financial assistance. Now we know that on the eve of the Yom Kippur War, Egypt was functionally bankrupt and could not pay its creditors. It received temporarily an influx of cash from the Soviets, but the Soviets were unreliable and not very wealthy. And America had a long record of paying people for their friendship, like an insecure teenager. And Egypt soon became the second largest recipient of American foreign aid after Israel. They had three good reasons why Sadat wanted to carve out his own path. In Dayan's meetings with Tuhami, the deputy foreign minister, he was still Sadat would visit. He would negotiate directly, but he would insist on a full withdrawal from Sinai and on all fronts, back to the 1967 lines. It's amazing how much the final agreement mirrored this initial discussion, which leads inevitably to the conclusion that Some of the haggling was for show. Some was to play to domestic audiences. Some by professional hagglers just to get the best deal they could. And some was over legitimate issues. And they both agreed to keep the U.S. out. Neither Sadat nor Begin wanted the Soviets. And Carter just kept pressing both to come to Geneva. But by the time Sadat came to Israel, he knew that he would get back all or most of Sinai. November 8th, 1977... Sadat announced at the opening of the Egyptian parliament that he's willing to go to the ends of the earth for peace, even to Jerusalem. Begin immediately had Sadat called to invite him. They used American ambassadors as intermediary. Sadat said no, he wants a written invitation. Ever hear a parent say to a child, what do you want, a written invitation? Yes, he wanted a written invitation, and he promptly received one as well. It was sent by a courier to the ambassador. To say the least, Israelis were shocked. Even people in government who knew what was going on were shocked because they didn't believe, they didn't think that Sadat would actually do it. The chief of staff was Mordechai Gur at the time, smelled a rat, and even suspected that Sadat's plane was a Trojan horse from which Egyptian commandos would burst out and mow down the entire Israeli cabinet. And he noted the Egyptian army was on high alert on the Suez. So why would that be? When he said as much to a reporter, a furious Azer Weizmann, the defense minister, said he's going to cut short his tenure as chief of staff by 4 months for that comment, to which Gur responded, if that's what you want, you can fire me now. Weizmann raced to Yerushalayim from the Kiryat Tel Aviv to consult Begin about firing Mata Gur. En route, he got into a terrible car accident that left him unconscious. So he never had that discussion with Begin. And in fact, Weizmann even missed the arrival ceremony that was timed for 3 hours after Shabbat ended on November 19, 1977, still in the hospital. Begin had consulted his staff to find out when Havdalah was. There's no Chil Shabbos at all. In fact, Weizmann was even more furious when watching on television from his hospital bed. He saw Gur warmly shake Sadat's hands. Just, he writes, it just infuriated him. Sadat had something personal to say to each dignitary. To some, he said, you didn't think I would come. To Sharon about his cross-canal invasion of Egypt in the Yom Kippur War. To Dayan, who was well known as a serial looter of antiquities, Sadat said, let me know when you want to visit Egypt. I'll lock up my museums. Sadat stayed in the King David Hotel on Sunday. He visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Later that day, addressed the Knesset, calling for peace, and a complete withdrawal to 1967 lines. The Americans were bewildered. Israelis were enthusiastic. Most of them. It was historic. It was dramatic. For many reasons, or for many people, suspicious also. You know, the Netziv writes on the encounter of Yaakov and Esav that as soon as Esav smiles at Yaakov, embraces Yaakov, Yaakov will give Esav everything that he wants. Many didn't trust Sadat, like me. It didn't help that in his visit to the Knesset, he wore a tie with swastikas on it. Now, I saw the picture that week. It's on display in the Begin Center in Israel. Here's the picture. You'll look at it later. Tell me what you think. But he broke the ice, and Israelis had felt isolated and unwelcome in the neighborhood. For some labor officials, there was tremendous resentment that Sadat had come now to their arch enemy Begin and not to them when they were in power. At the time, most Israelis, probably it's true today as well, wanted nothing more than acceptance and normalcy. And this was it. Sadat overnight had converted their conflict from an existential one into one over borders. But problems arose almost immediately. Sadat sincerely expected that his grand gesture, which in essence was saying, hello, how are you, would be reciprocated with another grand gesture, Israel's complete surrender on all fronts. Truth be told, there were two obstacles to a rapid resolution of this conflict on each side. Sadat hoped that other Arab nations would follow his lead, say hello, get your land back, move on with your lives, but they didn't. Arafat and the PLO whom Sadat had privately denounced as pygmies and hired killers, they denounced the entire process as a sellout. No other Arab country supported him, even Jordan, which really surprised Sadat, and he was ostracized. But historians differ on the following, we'll never know. Sadat never supported a Palestinian state, even though he made reference to it. He hated Arafat. He had no use for the Palestinians, which is true for almost every Arab leader. But he went to great lengths to negotiate on their behalf. And the question was he sincere? Or was he just looking for a fig leaf to cover him on the way to a separate peace? In the Knesset, he said he would not sign a separate peace, but how that would be accommodated would be a major flashpoint. The other obstacle was Begin, and understandably so. Begin wanted nothing more than a separate peace. In 1957, he had lambasted Ben-Gurion, heckling him in the Knesset for conquering the Sinai the year before, and then hastily withdrawing under pressure. In fact, the Chairut MKs had predicted right then and there that Israel would have to fight again in the Sinai, and it happened. So wasn't he doing the exact same thing? He would say no, he'd say he's withdrawing for a peace treaty, but even Begin had not said that he would withdraw completely, and certainly not uproot the Jews living in the settlements in Sinai, 4,000 strong, including the town of Yamit. Begin would only agree at first to a substantial withdrawal from Sinai, which he thought was not part of Eretz Yisrael. By the time Rav Gorin corrected him, it's Eretz Yisrael formally up to El Arish, Nachal Mitzrayim, it was too late. But only because in his mind, an agreement with Egypt would safeguard Jewish settlement in Yesha. And that was his strategic choice, to sign a peace treaty with Egypt, get the largest Arab country, then leader of the Arab world, out of the circle of confrontation states, and that would protect the heartland, allow Jews to settle, develop it, and ensure there'd be no more wars. But what Israel wanted most was a separate peace. Remember, Begin had not even accepted the applicability of UN Resolution 242 on every front. And in fact, he resigned from the government, the Meir government, only time he was part of the government in the 29 years of opposition, to protest even the suggestion of a withdrawal from Yesha. Without Egypt, the Arab world could not wage open war against Israel. No other combination of countries was strong enough. In that, whatever we say about the treaty, and many opposed it, I opposed it myself, not that it mattered to anybody, maybe to Karen it mattered, Begin was right. There hasn't been a war of nations against Israel since. The war shifted to a war of proxies, of terror, and then with the Oslo debacle, into a civil war in the heartland of Israel. But you haven't had that conglomerate of states challenging Israel nation to nation since the Yom Kippur War. There was much to discuss. Begin was a born negotiator, a haggler, a stickler for details, for words, phrases, clauses. He was very lawyerly, having trained as a lawyer at the University of Warsaw. In another secret meeting, December 1977, Dayan offered the demilitarization of Sinai from the Mitlan Gidi passes until the Israeli border, and the retention of Israeli settlements there under UN jurisdiction. Tuchami insisted that was not enough, and a full peace with all Arab states was required. That was a sure deal killer. When Begin and Dayan made their first visit to Egypt, Ismailia, December 25th, Dayan noticed that in contrast to Israel's greeting of Sadat, there were no Israeli flags out, there was no formal welcome, there were no crowds. Sadat's welcome in Israel had tremendous pomp associated with it. Begin's visit to Egypt, none. It was an indication of a fundamental difference between the two men, as well as a harbinger of what is today a cold peace. In the meantime, everything stalled because Sadat was insisting on full withdrawal from all fronts, period. Nothing happened for months, and by this time Jimmy Carter reinserted himself into the process at Sadat's insistence he should pressure Israel, and now began openly taking Egypt's side in the dispute. Something else happened. Now we're March 1978. As Begin prepared for another trip to Washington, a group of 350 reservists signed an open letter calling on Begin to concede. This group would eventually become Peace Now, which haunts Israeli politics and diplomacy until today, although they've been muted the last few years or so. That same month, a terrorist attack on a bus on Route 2, the Tel Aviv-Haifa road, killed 39 Israelis. Operation Litani was launched to clear out the PLO presence in southern Lebanon, but each act of self-defense grated on Carter. In fact, then he accused Israel for the first time of using American weapons illegally, cluster bombs. And Begin's failure to respond to Sadat with a complete renunciation of every Israeli claim irritated him even more. Now for Carter, this would be a double windfall that he saw on the horizon. If he could move Begin, then a treaty would be signed without the Soviets, and Egypt and Israel would both be American allies, anchoring U.S. policies in the region. And Carter was especially angered by Israel's refusal to commit to any concessions on the Western Front. Begin couldn't be clearer. I quote, "Israel will not transfer Judea, Samaria, and Gaza district to any foreign sovereign authority. Because of the historic right of our nation to this land, the needs of our national security, which demand a capability to defend our state and the lives of our citizens." And a stalemate developed. Sadat stopped speaking to Begin. That lasted through the summer of 1978. Israelis were on alert for a possible war with Egypt, and it led Carter to invite, even cajole, all parties to Camp David. Well, everyone was invited. Obviously, only Israelis and the Egyptians showed up. And there they gathered in the presidential retreat in the Catoctin Mountains, about 60 miles northwest of Washington. Camp David, named for Eisenhower's grandson David, today respected historian. FDR was the first to use the premises. He called it Shangri-La, but that name never caught on. So the conference began, the summit began September 5th, 1978, continued for 13 difficult days. Every day, negotiations, except for the two Shabbosos, on which Begin refused to negotiate. But they were shut off from the world. News blackout, no statements. Twice the talks nearly ended. When Israel threatened to leave, Egypt threatened to leave. But Carter had much invested in the outcome, and he pressured Israel relentlessly, as Israel was the party with real concessions to make, and that's always been the problem. Israel's always asked to sacrifice the tangible for the intangible. And once the tangible is gone, it's not coming back that easily. And Israel's been forced to accept what, to my thinking, is a most execrable formula, land for peace, which is why I've always opposed these treaties. Land for peace is essentially a reward for aggression. A country attacks, loses, and then asks that the land from which it launched the invasion is restored to it. So there's no downside to attacking and losing if there's such a policy as land for peace. Is there anything more preposterous? Has it ever been applied anywhere else in the world to any other country? And you add to that the ludicrousness of the other catchphrase that's taken from the UN Charter that played a role here as well, the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force. What's that? Tell that to the Americans. The whole country was taken by force. Tell it to the Soviets, to the Russians. What's going on in the world today? So today, the Obama administration announced, yesterday actually, that they do not want Ukraine to split into two countries. The pro-Soviet, the pro-Russian rather, the pro-European. But the fact is, Western Ukraine was stolen from the Poles. It was Eastern Poland until World War II. The Soviets kept it. That is the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force. Lvov, for example, is a Ukrainian city since the war. Was it ever Ukraine? It's a Polish city. The French, the British, every nation exists because it conquered its territory by force. Doesn't California belong to the Mexicans? I think they're taking it back, by the way. But such rules only apply to Israel. So what took so long, 13 days? What were the issues? There were different expectations going in. As I said, Begin wanted peace with Egypt and the preservation of Eretz Yisrael. Sadat wanted the former, but not the latter. Sadat's visit to Yerushalayim did not make him a Zionist, even if it made him a pariah in the Arab world. So Sadat wanted a permanent resolution of the status of Yesha, even though he wasn't a party to it. Now think of this, it also is a little absurd. Israel be expected to make concessions in advance in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza without negotiating with the relevant parties, the Jordanians or the people Begin called the Arabs of Eretz Yisrael. Both Begin and Sadat and Carter were strong personalities, deeply religious in their own way, so strong that Begin and Sadat stopped speaking together after the first day, after an acrimonious shouting match that got very personal. And for most of the time, Carter had to shuttle from cabin to cabin, talking to both, and Begin came on the defensive, expecting pressure. And he didn't bring with him any real right-wingers to bolster him. He had Weizmann, he had Dayan, he had two legal advisors. One was Aaron Barak, who became the most leftist Supreme Court justice in history, and Meir Rosen, who's a foreign ministry official. It was Begin who in December 1977 had already offered the Aravei Eretz Yisrael autonomy, saying in essence, to the Arabs as individuals, everything. To the Arabs as a people, nothing. They could govern their own lives, but without any national status. Citizenship could be Jordanian. At one point, even offered Israeli citizenship if they wanted. But Carter had already a year before started braying about what he called, I quote, the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people and their just requirements, including the right of self-determination. Sadat agreed, even though he didn't want a Palestinian state, because that would give him cover, he thought, with other Arabs. Once there's an agreement to remove Israeli soldiers from Yesha, even to relocate them, that's tantamount to an agreement to withdraw, a renunciation by Israel of any sovereign claims. But Begin insisted on making those sovereign claims and would not relent. And full withdrawal was another sticking point. Begin was against uprooting Jews. The thought sickened him. Bad memories of the Holocaust. And Sadat refused to have any remnant of Israeli rule. Begin even suggested that that the Sinai settlements could be restored to Egyptian sovereignty, but the settlers would remain under IDF protection. You hear that echo today as well. Sadat was adamant, no Jew will be left behind. Carter made the first breakthrough about 10 days into the conference on the issue of linkage. Sadat said it would be peace with Israel and a resolution of Yesha. They went together, and Carter said they would separate the two, really have two separate frameworks that would be independent, would even be signed on two different documents, as it was. It acknowledged Resolution 242, even though Begin would not sign an agreement that explicitly applied it to all fronts, it was implicit. They agreed there'd be a self-governing authority established in Yesha, autonomy. Once established, a five-year transition period would go into effect, in which after 3 years, negotiations would begin as on a permanent resolution, permanent solution, borders, sovereignty, security, and all. And that solution, the text said, would account for, I quote, the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people and their just requirements. In this way, the Palestinians will participate in the determination of their own future. Note the phrase, Begin haggled at every word. It's not quite self-determination, against which Begin was adamant, but even agreeing to the phrase, legitimate rights, was a major concession, not just in negotiations, but in Begin's worldview, and has in fact harmed Israel's cause ever since. Now, Begin came from a tradition in which the only legitimate sovereign between the river and the sea was the Jewish state. To effectively renounce that less than a year and a half after being in power was a sea change and not happily done. But Begin, ever the lawyer, felt if legitimate rights were not spelled out, he could darshan them any way he wanted. Yeah, legitimate right to breathe air. So he had red lines that Sadat had to accept. Nothing about self-determination, and so no Palestinian state, no withdrawal from Yesha, and no mention of Yerushalayim as even negotiable. From any of those, Begin would have walked away and almost did. On day 11, Sadat packed his bags to leave when Dayan said Israel's concessions were finished. In a one-on-one shouting match in Sadat's cabin with his suitcases packed, Carter told Sadat if he left, their friendship was over and American-Egyptian relations would severely suffer. So he stayed and more concessions came. There'd be normal diplomatic relations between Israel and Egypt, the establishment of embassies, end to the economic boycott, free passage through the Straits of Tehran, and of course peace, an end to the state of war. Sinai would return to Egyptian sovereignty and for the most part be demilitarized. A UN force would serve as a buffer. And finally, Begin, after calling Sharon and winning his support, agreed to evacuate the settlements in Sinai and expel the 4,000 Jews, all subject to a vote of the Knesset. Now, bear in mind, in the months preceding, Begin had said he would never do that. He even said, he vowed that when he retired, he would move to Yamit. That's how rhetorical he was. But he agreed to do it. He agreed to a gradual but a full withdrawal with the extent of normalization linked to the extent of the withdrawals. Meanwhile, Sadat was insisting that one place be mentioned as well, Yerushalayim. Unless Israel agrees that the status of Yerushalayim is to be negotiated as well, there would be no agreement. Begin told him to go fly a kite or the Yiddish equivalent. He would never agree to put Yerushalayim on the table, not even in the document. On the last day, Carter said he issued an American letter about American thoughts to Yerushalayim, and Begin said he would just walk away from everything if that were the case. So the issue was finessed. There was no American letter. Instead, I have a copy here. You're happy to read it later. Sadat and Begin both wrote letters to Carter about Yerushalayim. Sadat stated his position that Arab Jerusalem is an integral part of the West Bank and must be under Arab sovereignty, and Begin wrote in his letter that he has the honor to inform President Carter that pursuant to Israeli law, June 28, 1967, Jerusalem is one city, indivisible, the capital of the State of Israel, period. These last concessions were made in the last 2 days after Carter had taken Sadat and Begin on a tour of the battlefield at Gettysburg, which is about 30 miles or so to the northeast. Camp David, the northern part of Maryland, Gettysburg, the southern part of Pennsylvania, just to give them food for thought. Meanwhile, in another argument, Begin refused to sign a document that referred to the West Bank because he had banned those terms, compromise. The Hebrew agreement would read Yudas Shamron ve'Aza, and the English and the Arabic text would say West Bank. Camp David Accords were signed at the White House Sunday night, September 17th, 1978. Begin looked relieved but pained when he spoke. He later compared the experience to being in a concentration camp. When he spoke, you'll recall if you saw it, he took time, prime time, to say, now I want to say a few words to my people in Hebrew, and he just monopolized the American airwaves speaking Hebrew to Israelis. I think it was the first time I heard Hebrew spoken on American television. The accord still had to be finalized in a peace treaty, and there too problems arose in the ensuing months. Begin immediately returned to Israel. Soon the Knesset voted overwhelmingly to approve the accords and the destruction of the Sinai settlements, 84 in favor, 19 against, 17 abstentions. The Knesset speaker, Yitzhak Shamir, abstained, as did Yigal Alon on the left. Moshe Arens, new to Likud, voted against, as did Shlomo Hillel on the left. If you crunch the numbers, only nine of 21 Chirut MKs voted for the agreement. Only five of the Mafdal MKs. By then the coalition was 70 members, only 47 voted for the agreement, so the opposition had to push it through. To make amends, Begin then began building more settlements in Yesha, directing Sharon to build and build, so agriculture minister at the time, angering Carter, who thought Begin had agreed to a freeze During negotiations, Begin said yes, a limited freeze of 3 months during the negotiations with Egypt. Not permanently, Carter thought it would be permanently or for 5 years, but the concept of the freeze, as we know, lives on also. Other issues cropped up. Carter engaged in more shuttle diplomacy, March 1979, to finalize the treaty. The treaty was long and exhaustively detailed about the withdrawal and establishment of relations and about oil. Israel gave back all the oil fields. They would have been energy self-sufficient. Tourism, other details. Israel insists, it was a key point, that this treaty supersede all other treaties Egypt had, especially the 1950 Arab Defense Agreement that stated that if one Arab state's attacked, all Arabs must come to its defense. Sadat was pressured into agreeing, which really sealed his fate with the Arab world, which soon began an economic boycott of Egypt. Egypt then insisted on a role in Gaza, and Israel refused. Now, both Begin and Sadat, not Carter, had already won the Nobel Prize for Peace in December 1978, a tad premature, but the treaty was approved by the Knesset March 21st, 1979, after 28-hour debate. That's a lot of talking. 95-18-2. Eventually, part of Likud would break away. New party, Hatriya, would represent the right wing of Israeli politics until it collapsed. But Begin still had enough credibility and oratorical skills to maintain his base of support. So the treaty was signed at the White House, March 26, 1979. Begin, true to form, gave an inspiring speech, calling this the third greatest day in his life after Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Shichrur Yerushalayim. And he spoke about how he had suffered under the Nazis and under communism, as parents had been slaughtered, al Kiddush Hashem, and all because the Jews did not have a country of their own, an army of their own, no place of refuge, no army to defend them. And then he donned the yarmulke, and he read in Hebrew the whole text, Shir HaMalos, B'Shuv Hashem, Shiva Zion, Ha'iru Kicholmim, without comment or translation, ending simply, I will not translate. Every man, whether Jew, Christian, or Muslim, can read it in his own language. It is Psalm 126. Well, the withdrawals took place on schedule, as did the exchange of ambassadors, as did the expulsion from Sinai, carried out by the new defense minister, Ariel Sharon. There was more resistance there in Yamit than in Sharon's next expulsion in Gush Katif, but it was completed April 23rd, 1982. Sadat was not around to see it. The previous October, Sadat had been killed by the Muslim Brotherhood while reviewing a parade celebrating Egypt's victory in the Yom Kippur War. How ironic is that? Now, the eulogizers to this day attributed his assassination to the peace treaty, but it's a bit of an exaggeration. The fact is, for sure, the treaty with Israel played a role, but Sadat had also imprisoned leading members of the Muslim Brotherhood without trial and angered them, not only by the treaty, but by Sadat's attempt to westernize Egypt and by his increasing repression. So Sadat became a happy recipient of American aid, ongoing, as did Israel. But Begin foolishly rejected Carter's offer that the U.S. would pay to build new airfields for Israel in place of the ones Israel gave up in Sinai. Begin's pride took over, and he asked for loans instead. You don't have to pay for me. And of course, this placed a tremendous burden on Israel's economy for years. There was a separate deal that they would have to negotiate for 5 years autonomy for the Arabs of Eretz Yisrael. The autonomy talks went nowhere. The PLO denounced Camp David as a diabolical plot and doubled down on their hatred of Israel, and now of Egypt as well. There were Egyptians who were killed, victims of Arab terror. Jordan never joined the talks, and autonomy was never established in any meaningful way until the 90s. Begin had little interest in it. And proof of this, I knew it would go nowhere, was when he appointed Yosef Burg, who was the head of the Mafdal, to lead the Israeli delegation. Burg could just talk and talk. And in 9 languages, he could talk. And Begin just wanted the appearance of negotiations without the substance. That led Dayan and Weizmann to resign, Sharon, the new defense minister, Shamir, the new foreign minister. For his efforts, Carter got no bounce from the Camp David Accords of the peace treaty and his popularity in America. People just didn't care about it that much. And he'd be defeated in the 1980 elections. Well, here's the final question. Was it worth it in retrospect? The truth is, I watched the scene on March 26, 1979, with sadness and trepidation, a sick feeling in my stomach. So was it warranted? For sure, the Camp David Accords were a paradigm shift in the Middle East conflict. Egypt became not only the first Arab country to recognize Israel, it was the largest Arab country and the most powerful. So taking Egypt out of the war equation made war against Israel by Arab nations impossible. And there's been no war against Israel since. So from that perspective, the Camp David Accords were validated. It essentially produced a separate peace between Egypt and Israel. As Rabbi Wein used to note, you know, a few times you find the phrase in Sefer Shoftim, Vatishko Taaretz Arba'im Shana, Vatishko Taaretz Esrim Shana. And the land was quiet, there was peace, a respite for 20 years, for 40 years. He said, if the Tanakh records such a thing, it means it's a phenomenon not to be lightly dismissed. It's even quiet for 40 years. And the oil and gas from Egypt has flowed consistently, except for some recent turmoil. But, by the same token, there's been almost no belligerency between Israel and Syria during the same period of time, without peace and without a withdrawal. So who's to say that the same situation could not have prevailed in the south? On the other hand, it's quite possible that Syria's been inhibited for decades because of the peace with Egypt, so that could be argued both ways. And Syria's had to resort to proxy wars, except for its brief involvement in the battles in Lebanon, but those proxy wars have been harmful to Israel. Not existential threats, but terribly costly in terms of human life and financial hardship and propaganda defeats. Moreover, Egypt's isolation, the Arab world, left a vacuum that Saddam Hussein filled. And that itself posed a whole new set of challenges to Israel, as we'll discuss in the future. And Egypt never warmed to the concept of peace with Israel, so as to try to diminish and then eliminate its Arab isolation. And that worked. There was never much tourism from Egypt to Israel. There was from Israel to Egypt. Today, of course, very little also. Relations for decades have been formal, not cordial, certainly not friendly. Whether Sadat's death played a big role as possible, certainly the cold peace reflected Mubarak's distaste for Israel. In 30 years as the dictator, he never formally visited Israel even one time, except briefly for Rabin's funeral. Mubarak preferred better ties with Arabs than any real bond with Israel, but in a sense he kept the peace, and so far the treaty has withstood all the turmoil in Egypt, although Morsi promised to abolish it while he was in power, stopped only by the threat of a cutoff of American aid. Domestically, the Camp David Accords were a sea change for Israel. The ideology of the right was emasculated, and probably permanently. Israel accepted the absurdity of land for peace without real opposition, and in accepting essentially the notion of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, it essentially undermined its claim to any land conquered in 1967. So from one perspective, the world, biased to begin with, justly wonders how Israel can continue to occupy land that it concedes belongs to another nation. I don't believe for a moment they're sincere, but Israel weakened its claim by accepting that narrative. And if Begin could do it, so to speak, rise to the occasion and adopt the policies of the left, then everyone should. And if Egypt recovered every inch, why not other Arab countries? So since then, the pattern of Israeli politics has been Labor proposes and Likud disposes. That is to say, Labor suggests withdrawals, retreats, surrenders, Likud castigates them, and then does the same when they are in power. They actually execute those plans. If Sadat had come to Israel when Rabin was prime minister, Begin would have been railing against the treaty. Except for Shamir, who always remained resolute and principled, every Likud leader has risen to power in the Likud by preaching a hard line and then caving when in office. whether Netanyahu the first, or Sharon, or Olmert, or Netanyahu again, it makes one wonder what their real values are, and world leaders are quite conscious of that frailty. Well, there's obviously a direct line between the Camp David Accords and the Oslo Accords, even though the obvious difference as well, you know, the autonomy from the 90s on was basically what was foresaw in the Accords. But even the Oslo Accords made no reference to self-determination by Palestinians, and that's way past that. But as Israel reversed its trend of incessant war and unending strife with all its neighbors, it also paved the way for future concessions and future deterioration of its strategic position, as we see now, struggling to hold on to the Jordan Valley and Yerushalayim, much less Judea and Samaria. And much like Oslo would do later, the Camp David Accords just whetted the world's appetite for Israeli concessions as the only way to peace. So was it worth it? Was it a good decision? Kissinger writes that in the early 70s he asked the Chinese leader, Zhou Enlai, about the significance of the French Revolution from 1789. Zhou Enlai answered, "It's too soon to tell." Well, so too the Oslo Accords. Whether it's the first opening to the Arab states that strengthened Israel and enabled it to focus on nation building, or the beginning of Israel's decline as it lost faith in the justice of the Zionist vision, it is simply too early to tell. Come back here in 100 years. I thank you all very much.